Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2011. Lecture 2, delivered on August 24, 2011. The title of this lecture is Foundations of Finance.
Today, Foundations of Finance. This lecture will include a little bit of several topics, including business organization and how what interest rates are, why there are interest rates. And along the way, I'm going to introduce you briefly, and I will probably have to finish this topic on Monday, agency theory. Now, agency theory is the place where I teach you how to see the world in the darkest, grimmest way possible. You see your fellow human as essentially nothing but a lazy slacker waiting to take advantage of you. In other words, it's a topic I like. But we start with a couple of basic ideas here. By the way, the textbook goes into this part in chapter one, and I know a lot of you have read chapter one. Consider you were bitching at me about what the assignment was that you had to turn in with it. There is no assignment. But in chapter one, they go into this thing, all the different jobs in business, the comptroller, the vice president of finance, the treasurer, and all that. No, I'm not going to ask you about that. Don't read that. Well, read it, but just kind of dismiss it. Okay? I don't care. If you get into the world of finance, and if you actually got a job in finance, you'll find out what the structure and the hierarchy is, and it is slightly different from company to company. And a lot of what you do during your life is going to be lateral movements with every now and then a pop to another level. That's going to be true no matter what field you go into in business. So you'll find that stuff out along the way, and I'm not going to waste my time having you learn that, waste your time. There are some important things, though, in those first couple of chapters. One of them has to do with business organizations. Now, I don't go into a lot of long-winded stuff about the sort of the hybrids, the LLCs. I'll mention that to you. But there are three basic organizational forms of a business. And this gets, it sounds very technical and not a whole lot to memorize once you get the hang of how the organizations work. But at the end of the day, there's something almost creepy about the last business organization type I'm going to tell you. Now, I'm a finance and economics professional. I don't get into philosophy unless I'm drunk. And so once you are old enough, if you want to talk philosophy, we'll go to some place, a quiet place where we can get blottoed enough that I actually will talk about it. But just to touch on the philosophy, when we get to the theory of the corporation, you're going to find out that a corporation really is a being. Now, there's a lot of discussion now and some great dismay because the Supreme Court has recognized essentially what are human rights that corporations have under our Constitution. The Supreme Court last year recognized a pretty much an absolute right of free speech to corporations, saying they are persons under the Constitution and therefore must be accorded free speech rights. And there was a lot of upset about that. You're treating corporations as if they have all the rights of humans, citizens, And the answer to that is, well, sort of, yeah. But that was not as dramatic as a lot of people had made it out to be. The Supreme Court had been moving towards this for at least 3 decades, maybe, recognizing a broader and broader right of speech that was accorded under our Constitution to corporations. But under our system of laws, a corporation is a person, legally a person. That is just the reality of it. And in fact, that has some linguistic background to it, which I can't get into with you here in this course. But the idea is that, look, I'm going to do a lecture on contract law. And I know most of you have already had a business law course of some kind. You didn't have it from me, so it wasn't the best. But I am going to give you one lecture in contract law, enough to give you some background. But in a contract isn't always between two people, two human beings. Contracts can be between an individual and a business, between two businesses all the time. So in contract law, we have to recognize a personhood of a business so that we can say, party of the first and party of the second, and treat each of the parties as persons, even if they are organizations of some kind. In fact, most of you will eventually be in a very powerful contract, an ancient contract, where there is a person that has no physical existence whatsoever. It's called a marriage. In a marriage, well, it's a very cold place anyway, trust me, but in a marriage, there are two people who are parties to the contract, but the contract creates a person called the couple that is recognized under the law as having rights and responsibilities under the law as a person. So when we get to corporations, you're going to find out that they are persons. Not people, they are persons under the law, and that has to be the case in order for you to have contracts and all of that. Here's the upshot of it, though. They're not people, and they're not persons like you and me. You see, because theoretically, a corporation does not have mortality. Now, most corporations die, or they merge, or they fade, and kind of just exist as almost like a shell. But theoretically, there is no limit on the life of a corporation. It can live forever. And that has a compelling consequence that gets to a philosophical level, which again, I will not get into. But don't fall into the trap of these, and I'm generally an old-time conservative, not these insane conservatives now, but I don't want you to get into the trap of these crazy teabagger types who think that, well, that just means that a corporation is a person, a people, as the governor of our adjacent state, Scott Walker, said last week. He said, corporations are people too. No, they're not. They are persons, and they are certainly not like you and me, because you and I have by definition, we die. We're mortals. Corporations, there is no existential reason that they die. So theoretically, a corporation can live forever. More importantly than that, we cannot punish a corporation like we can you. You can end up in prison being some hard-timer's old lady for a few years. Laugh if you will, you could be Large Marge's bunkmate. So you could be punished physically, mentally. You can be hurt in ways that affect you at a primal level. You can't do that to a corporation. You can't put it in prison. You cannot beat it. You cannot humiliate it. It is insentient. It has no feelings, like people do. Now, I don't like talking about feelings. That was way over the top, the way they did that to kids for years, turning them into a bunch of self-pitying people. But we do have feelings, and corporations don't. You can't make a corporation do what you wanted to do with a whip. You can with a person, but you can't with a corporation. Listen, the first type of organization, business organization, is so simple that almost all of you have actually been in that business, had one of those business organizations. You have been what we call sole proprietors. A sole proprietorship is just a one-man show or a one-woman show. A sole proprietorship. It's just a one-man show or a one-woman show. I hesitate to say one-person show because that word person can carry a wallop with it these days. But, okay, here's the deal. You can actually just set up and do some business. You have decided that you will mow lawns. You look like you can mow a lawn. So you get yourself a lawnmower and you mow lawns. And you are then, and okay, and you, you've mowed my lawn. And I say, okay, well, who do I make the check out to? And you say, well, make it out to, and you give me your name. So I write the check to you. Well, that would then be the doing business as of your company, the DBA. Now, you might decide that you want to be a little fancier and use a fictitious name, which reasonably you should register at the state level. You register those. Actually, it was weird. I've got a couple of DBAs here in Illinois, and you actually do it at the county recorder's office, not even at the state level. But you're protected. Your name is kind of protected then. So you might have Mower Man. Yeah, make it out to Mower Man. That's my DBA. And as long as your bank has gone along with this and you've shown documentation that this is, you're allowed to use this name, that's cool. Know this. Every penny of money that comes in is yours. You pay your bills, and if you run out of money and there are still bills, you're on the hook personally. They can take your mower. They can shoot your dog and take your Bible. Okay? And that means that if you're mowing someone's lawn in one of the fancy neighborhoods around town here like Ironwood, and you accidentally don't see the poodle, well, you know what? Fido was worth $2,500. Okay? So you're going to be on the hook for that much money. They can take your business assets, and then they will take your assets, with the emphasis on the first syllable. If you run out of money and you can't pay your bills, they will go through the business assets, and there is nothing that stops them from getting your assets too. Nothing in the world. So you are all at risk. You gain everything that you might, that is possible, but you are exposed to all of the risk of the business. Personally, as a human being. That's what a sole proprietorship is. Now, the next rung we go to is the partnership. Now, the partnership, I can assure you that there are so many flavors of partnership out there that it is just ridiculous. I actually engaged in constructing partnerships, limited partnerships. Specifically, I got into low-income housing for the elderly partnerships because you could just get money, zero interest and low interest loans from the state, from the federal government, and it was just like, it was like money engines. And that was a long time ago. And then everyone else figured out you could do it too, so the business kind of dried up on my end. But I mean, I did oil and gas partnerships and they, all kinds of weird arrangements you can do. The ones that were fascinating to me were in oil and gas, we'd set up what were called working interest partnerships. But I'll go through the basic idea. First, of a general partnership. In a general partnership, it's just more than one person all at risk. It's just they are jointly and severally more than one person all at risk. Now, at the partnership level, legally, It has to, you really do have to have a partnership agreement on file, and it has to be represented and qualified at the state level. But aside from that, it's essentially the general partnership, the 2, 3, 4, 5 of you just essentially run a business. You share the risks, you share the rewards. If you screw up, they'll go through the business assets, and then they will just cut right in and take everything that they need out of your personal assets, and you can't stop them. It's just that you are individually and jointly all at risk. These are simple business organizations, though. Although if you get into a general partnership, any kind of partnership, you better have a good contract set up, and you shouldn't try to review it yourself unless you're an expert in law. We're expert in contracts. Now, here's the interesting thing about sole proprietorships and general partnerships both. If you die, if anyone in the partnership dies, or if you die as a sole proprietorship, the company is gone. By definition, the company is over, done. That means in a partnership, if one of the partners kicks off, that's the end of the partnership. Now, you might be able to design some way to reconstitute a new partnership, but that partnership that existed, which definitionally was the body of the partners, is over, done, gone. Like I said, you can construct so that it doesn't even look like the partnership goes away. But that requires some pretty fancy planning, and it's done all the time in professional partnerships like law firms. But at its heart, these are people. They really are human beings, and they are mortal. They go away. So here we go. Now, by the way, let me give you a little bit of insight here. Now, the general partnership isn't the only one. As a matter of fact, I don't know how many general partnerships I've seen in the last couple of decades. More likely, what you're going to see is some flavor on what's called a limited partnership. Now, a limited partnership, and I'm going to tell you some of the ones that I worked in. I never did a general partnership, but I did limited partnerships. Now, a limited partnership works like this. You have two different classes of partners. There are the general partners. They are all at risk. They have all management rights. They usually take the lion's share of the winnings, if there are winnings. And then you have limited partners. The limited partners, their liability, their exposure is limited to their investment. But they are not allowed to touch management issues. They have to just step back and watch the show. They are absolutely prohibited from anything that would be related to the operation of the business. Now, I'll tell you a couple of variations on these. The first exposures I had to them were actually indie films. And when I say indie, yes. That's how they were funded, and they still are to this day, many of them. General partners would set it up, and then they would sell units for the action. In other words, we're going to need $1 million. What we're going to do is sell $50,000 units in the limited partnership. And then what we'll do is we'll produce it somewhere, take about 2-3 days to throw it together, get the tapes, the VHS and beta tapes in those days, spun out, and then what we'll do is we'll move it out into the market and we'll make plenty of money for us. We'll keep lots of padded expenses, and then we will transfer a good winning, maybe $75,000-$100,000 to the limited partners. And this is true in indie films to this day. Many of them are general RR limited partnerships. In fact, some of the mainline films you've seen in your lives were limited partnerships. They are very common to this day. And in fact, even in the distribution business, which is a huge aspect in movie, in the overall totality of movie making, some of the big names at least started out as limited partnerships in the business. I saw one of them. I thought it was the stupidest idea in the world in its day. A limited partnership for the distribution of a movie? What? Really? Yeah, it actually worked, and that company was started doing more and more of them, and it turned into one of the distribution companies that you would recognize its logo right off the bat if I told it to you. And so, yeah. Now, another one that I played, and this one I want to key on for a minute here, is the ones that I did, the low-income housing for the elderly. What we would do is we would set up, we're going to build this low-income housing for old people. Nice apartments, you know, not crap at all. They were really nice, and painted walls, nice rooms, nice carpet. But what we would do is we would get the government at the federal and the state level to provide low and no interest loans for us to do the building. And we would also get some grants for it. And then we would have this continuing program of subsidizing the rent for these people, because these were old people who didn't have a whole lot of money. You know, you're talking about back in that day, you'd have an elderly couple maybe in their mid-70s. They might have between them $1,200 a month. They couldn't afford a rent for a decent place of $800. So the government's whole idea was, well, let's subsidize it. We'll give incentives for builders to build these, and then we'll essentially provide for the management company that runs them. We'll say, all right, you're going to market is about $800 a month in rent. Okay, we're going to cut that. We'll pay half of it. So that we'll give $400 to you for every rental you do, so you have to charge the old people only $400 a month. It was actually a great program, and a number of nice apartment complexes around the country came up through these programs. Here's our angle on it. We'd set up a general limited partnership. And what we would do is we would go to lots and lots of investors, rich people, doctors, dentists, lawyers, accountants, finance people. And we would say, all right, here's the partnership deal. $20,000 buys you a unit in this partnership. And they would invest, one of the limited partnership units. And they would invest, okay, we're going to do this one that you're doing here in Indianapolis, or we're going to do this one you're doing up near Toledo. And we'd get it going. Now, here's the thing. What we would do is then send them a statement every year. Now, notice I didn't say we'd send them money every year. We didn't. We, in fact, sent them a couple of statements. We would send them one telling them how much money they had lost on the project. We'd send them another separate statement that told them how much they had lost through depreciation of the apartment complex over the year. And that would be what we would send them. And you know what? Those, you think they really, really were angry at us? They were thrilled. They loved this. You understand what we were doing? For $20,000, they would, for 10, 15, 20 years, get these statements every year telling them that they had lost $2,000, $3,000, $5,000, $7,000, so that they could put that loss against their taxable income. When you were talking about people at the 40% tax bracket and they had income of $500,000, every time you gave them that paper loss, they were saving 40% times that paper loss against their real income from their real work. Do you kind of see what we were doing? We were essentially creating paper loss vehicles. And you think, well, that's got to be illegal. No, the government knew we were doing it. That was why we did it. so that we could attract wealthy capital that would participate in something that rich people wouldn't do, build houses for old people. They wouldn't do this on their own. So we created these limited partnerships. They would burn out. Each one would last a certain number of years, and then the partnership would go away. The apartment complex would be fully depreciated and all that kind of stuff. We'd do it as fast as we could. And these wealthy people, they would be calling us all the time. What else you got? You got any this year? What kind of partnerships you got? You got any we can invest in? So it was a big, big thing, limited partnerships like this. And so they are not just business organizations that produce products. They actually are business organizations that produce paper losses sometimes. They produce actually physically good things for people who would otherwise not have them. You know, if you don't like these kinds of government programs and the fact that we are giving tax breaks to the wealthy, well, you find another way for us to get doctors and lawyers and dentists and all of that to directly invest in housing for people that really need a place to live and they don't have the money that rent that would be charged if they didn't have these subsidized programs. Let me mention one other one. This one I found out, it was like a blind side. One of the things I found out was when I came out of all my financial training in college and my grad stuff, I found out, oh, there's a world out there and I don't know what the hell most of this is all about. So I'm trying to convey some of that to you real quick here. I got into oil and gas in Texas. By the way, in Texas, there are no two-syllable words. It's not Texas, it's Texas. You don't go to Dallas, you go to Dallas, Houston. And it's not oil and gas, it's own gas. One syllable words, everything, okay? So it was oil and gas I got into. And they actually brought me in because it was a small wildcat group and they said, well, we'd like to start doing these on our own. And they explained to me the concept. It's called working interest partnerships. You have the general partners. They are the actual oil men. They're the ones who actually go out there, get the equipment, one of their guys is a geologist or sort of a facsimile thereof, figures out a place where they might be able to punch and get a couple of oil wells going, nothing spectacular. It's not like gushers of oil. Never saw that happen. But they would have the general partners. And then what they would do is they would set up a kind of limited partnership and sell units in it. Now, what we would do is we would set it up, and then we would come back north into this territory, Illinois, Ohio, Indiana, Wisconsin. And we'd find men, guys, who wanted to feel like they were macho and butch. And we would approach them for investments. We'd always come in our Red Wing boots and our big belt buckles, looking a little bit more ridiculous than we were. And we'd meet with them at some restaurant. I ain't going to go to no fancy $2,000 a meal restaurant. We're going to meet at some place like Denny's. You okay with that? Yeah. And then you'd sell them an oil project. Well, we got a grobbing out there on the oil patch, and we were looking at it. We figured there's prospect for oil down there somewhere. Now, there's no guarantee, but we'd like to punch for it. And we like to have you invest in it. You seem like the kind of man who understands this kind of stuff and you're okay with this. Well, we'd like to have you invest. We got more suckers that way than you would believe. So we get the money. The limited partnership had an odd little twist to it because you see, when you punch for oil, you're probably, first of all, not going to find it. Second of all, if you find it, it's going to be a bitch to get at it, and you're probably going to end up having to do some workouts along the way, which is where you have a busted pipe or something like that, and you have to punch in from the side to pull the oil up from where the pipe, underneath where the pipe is bad. You're going to have all kinds of problems. Sometimes you're going to find oil, but it's just going to be terribly difficult oil, or you're going to run into some problem with the Railroad Commission, which is what the body in Texas that oversees oil and gas exploration and exploitation. But what we would do is we'd sell them the interest. But in order for them to keep their percentage interest, they had to keep putting money in to the project when the project needed more money. If there was a cost that was $10,000, They had to pay that cost in order to maintain their percentage stake in the limited partnership. If they didn't pay it, they lost part of their stake, and they lost fast. So essentially, we set up these limited partnerships so that they were like parasites, so that we could just keep tapping these guys for more money. Legally, they had to pay it if they wanted to stay for the win, if there ever was going to be a win. And we could sit back and just essentially pay ourselves our salaries out of what we were taking from them and all that. So you got the idea of a working interest partnership. I just want to give you the all these different weird variations. And I just tell you a couple. There are thousands I've seen. And some of them are the deepest, deepest scams in the world. By the way, working interest partnerships, were they a scam? Oh, heck no. Those guys, even when they lost money, they got something out of it. They could brag to their friends that they were in oil and gas, and they were good buddies with some real Texas oil men who talked about loud machines, big oil, and generally very attractive Texas women. And so that made them feel real butch. Even if they didn't make a dime, they came out smiling. Except for the one whose wife found out that he'd blown close to 50 grand. Does that sound cold-hearted? Welcome to business. The last one is the pinnacle, the ultimate in the business evolution. It is the corporation. And I'll tell you, and the way I'm going to do this, I'm going to just tell you how a corporation comes into existence. I actually went back a couple of years ago because I kept saying, I've created a lot of corporations. I went back and made a count. I've actually created fewer than I thought. I've created only 14. But it all works the same way. Matter of fact, as I recall, 12 of them are now dead. You know, that will bite me. I still did it. Okay. First thing you do is you have an idea. A business idea. Now, it might have been like a DBA, a sole proprietorship, or usually a partnership. And I'm giving you sort of like a synthesis of some of the real thing as I did it. Finally, there comes a time when you're talking among yourselves, look, this is getting serious. We've actually made a little money in this, but, you know, we also have risks in this business, and we don't want to be all at risk anymore. And we also need to start raising serious money if we're going to go to the next level. You're not going to get a lot of serious money if you're a sole proprietor. It just isn't going to happen. You're going to probably not get a whole lot of money unless you're really smart in partnerships and you've got the engine. Which I did back in the day, but not anymore, because now I'd probably end up in prison because I practiced law without a license, and now they get bitchy about that. Funny how that works. I'll tell you a story that sort of was the changeover and the transition for me sometime. But one night with this one group, we sat down at one of the guys. He had a nice house. He had a job. He had a day job. Most of the guys had day jobs. There were five of them, and I had been helping them get their books together and all that. And we sat down. They said, "Well, what's a corporation, and how do we do it? Is it true that a corporation is like a person, and if it does something wrong, no one can come to us? They can do only." Damage only to the corporation? I said, yes. It's essentially there is all of the liability is the corporation's. The owners are protected from liability. They it doesn't come through to them because the corporation is a separate thing under the law. They said, well, and they asked me, and I threw it back to them. They said, what do we do? Do we do this now? What's the downside? It sounds like it's only upside. I said, well, the downside is, first of all, you're going to obviously have to do some hellacious paperwork. Second of all, you can no longer just do things seat of the pants. You've got to be disciplined. You've got to, we'll get the books together next month. We're just kind of busy right now, you know, with the wife and the kids and all that. No, you got to get things done right now, right away. And just because you're not liable doesn't mean that a court cannot pierce that corporate veil. If you start playing your personal lives into the corporation, using the corporate debit and credit cards for your own personal use, a court is just going to pierce that corporate veil and let the debt holders come right through and eat you up. The court won't waste any time doing that. So you have to maintain that corporate veil by keeping your own lives separate from the corporation that you are forming. So we got it together. The first thing was, that meeting was the meeting of the organizers of the corporation. From that arose a document called the Articles of Incorporation. The Articles of Incorporation. Now, the Articles of Incorporation essentially is like explaining everything about the corporation. What its name is, what its business address is, what it's going to do. Who is the person who will receive notices, legal notices? In other words, the statutory agent for service of process. What happens once this becomes a corporation? The organizers are not the same as the people who would be in the corporation. What's going to govern this corporation? You have to explain that there is a set of bylaws, and the corporation's governance will pass to the bylaws after this document is filed. You also have to explain in numerical terms how the capital stock of the corporation is divided. The simplest way would be to break it into a large number of shares of common stock, traditionally with a very small par value. In other words, an liability exposure value per share. So you would form a corporation and say the capital stock of this corporation shall be divided into 100 million shares of common stock, par value 0.0001 per share common. And you'll see that in some of the financial statements, and you may have seen it in accounting, but you'll see it in a different light when I show it to you later in this course. But what that means is now the ownership is theoretically divisible into 100 million units. That doesn't mean that 100 million units are going to be outstanding right away. That is the authorized. And then the owners of the corporation, once the corporation is underway, will each probably receive some certain amount, like 5 million shares each, or some will get more, some will get less. But the basic articles of incorporation, what the corporation's name is, what its principal business is, in what state is it domiciled? In other words, where will these articles of corporation be filed? That will be the state of domicile. So if I do corporations in Delaware, which I almost always did, I did Delaware corporations because Delaware corporate law is so sophisticated, old, and the judges are so good. They're like magistrates. They're so understanding of law of the business that I almost always did it there. But know this, if I operated in, let's say, Ohio or Illinois, my business, I'm actually a foreign corporation in Ohio or Illinois. If I am domiciled, if I filed my articles of incorporation in Delaware, I'm a foreign corporation in every other state of the union. And literally a foreign corporation, because corporations are state entities. They are not federal entities. Most people don't know that. Corporations are state, not federal. There are federal laws that govern us up the butt, especially if we are involved in interstate commerce. But at our heart, when I have the organizers sign those articles of incorporation, we send them to the Secretary of State of the state of incorporation. So if I form a corporation in Delaware, we sign those, and by the way, in the articles, upon the filing of these articles of incorporation, the rights and duties of the organizers are dissolved, and all matters with respect to this are passed to the bylaws. The bylaws are all the rules, all the names of the officers and directors and all that. But anyway, you filed, I haven't done this in a few years. You filed it in triplicate with the State of Incorporation Secretary of State, and then there would be this review. Is everything in order? Now, understand that the Secretary of State does not approve a corporation. It merely qualifies the articles, which says there is no defect in this corporation. And then you get your copy back stamped, and you have become not that company anymore. That company becomes a separate entity under the law, completely other than you and any other owner. That thing is an entity under the law with its own rights under the state and federal constitutions and its own obligations under the laws of the state and the federal government. Literally, it is a living thing. And how serious is that? When you get those articles of incorporation back, that is a birth certificate. It literally has the effect and power of a birth certificate. But it goes beyond that. Because what will happen next is that you will immediately file with the federal government for an FEIN, a federal employer identification number. You file it on Form SS-9. Now, for years, the IRS has had this great system. You fill out the form, and then you can call this hotline, and they'll ask you, tell us what's in this box, this box, this box. Okay, now be sure you fax this to us within 24 hours, and right now we're going to give you your FEIN. So it's like a hotline fast track, but you have to make sure you get get the document, the SS-9, to them real quick. But that FEIN there, that is exactly like a social security number of a person. It is exactly the same. So what you're seeing is the birth and legal recognition of a being. It is a person that you and the other organizers just created. And it has all of the legal responsibilities and more of a person, except that it never dies, which means that you have a deep responsibility. And I will come to this in the next lecture, a fiduciary responsibility, which is the highest duty implied by law to take care of that corporation. Because as much as it can make the world better, it can cause a lot of damage. And it cannot, by its nature, die to end that damage. That's all I have for you in this lecture. I thank you.